For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, for the record, for the record. For the record, for the record, for the record, for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable.
Welcome to The Clink, coming to you live out of the Mount Woodgie Studios here in Currumbin. I have an amazing guest with a big story of redemption. This man was a man that worked with the law,
yep,
ended up breaking the law, and is now working with the law again, yeah, and helping many, many people. And breaking the law again.
Oh, no, I'm not breaking anymore. I've had
enough
of that.
Nigel Munt, mate, welcome.
Thanks
welcome
for having
to the
on,
Clink Studios. And, mate, for those that don't know you,
yep,
let's give a little bit of insight to who Nigel Munt is, and let's go back.
All right. Well, mate, I suppose the journey for me started when I left school and I went to work for this, which was at the time a fairly small law firm. And I really like doing injury claims for people. And so I was, you know, very heavily involved in building that part of the business. And
sure.
It went on to become a very, very large business. And I was fortunate enough to own a share of it from a very young age.
Can I just ask how many of you were involved in that share? Was it three or four?
There was myself and two other fellas that owned the business. Mm-hmm. And I think when I started, there was about 20 staff. And by the time we sold it, when I was about 37, we had about 160, 180 staff.
Wow.
And, a significant turnover. And it was a very successful business.
So here you are. You've kicked off a practice. 1994, you came to the bar. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was admitted in 1994. I did five-year articles. So it's like an apprenticeship.
Yep.
So straight out of school, straight into the 5 years and studied as well while I worked full-time.
And how did you find that? That was obviously with an established firm.
Yeah, that was with that firm. It was very hard, to sort of work full time, and then basically any holidays you had, you would have to do studying, and it was the study was a real headache because once you're sort of in the system and you're doing your day's work, you just wanted to work, and the study was such a distraction and hard. I hated it, but you just got to do it and you get through it.
So were you actually practicing the same sort of law as you are today? Injury?
Yeah,
But you specialise in?
Yeah, it was all accidents and claims, motor vehicle accidents, work accidents, stuff like that. And we were one of the pioneers in Queensland in that firm of advertising on a broad scale. And back in those days, it was when the law just changed because you were never allowed to advertise, and then you were. And,
oh, right, okay.
And we really took advantage of it. And, that was probably something that really allowed me to progress to a very senior level at such a young age because I was behind all that marketing side of it. And, I was there for sort of taking it from basically a very small, embryonic sort of situation to huge levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we progress in this conversation, the levels are phenomenal.
Yeah.
And we'll share that. How old were you?
Well, I was 24 when I became a lawyer and 25 when I bought a share in the business. And it sort of had an entity value, if you like. It went from being worth, when I bought in, I think it had a value of about, say, 500,000.
Sure.
And when we sold out, it was about 57 million over that 14-year period.
$57 million.
Yeah, it was crazy.
So here you are, a successful young lawyer.
Well, I was back then. I was very successful, and I probably didn't really ever appreciate it because I was always wanting more, and I was never satisfied, never happy with my lot in life. Despite looking back on it and going, objectively, I'd like 10% back, you know what I mean?
And with the sale, like coming up and it going up for sale,
yep,
and that value of 57, you said?
Yeah.
Million dollars. What was Nigel looking at doing? And we'll talk, as I said, further, but hypothetically, it's for sale, you've got an opportunity, you're young, the world's your oyster.
I was sort of in a situation where I was transitioning away from working in law anyway, because the one thing about lawyers is that nearly every lawyer you ever meet wants to be something other than a lawyer.
Sure.
That's why so many of them have, unsuccessful restaurants and barbecue shops and you name it. Everyone who's a lawyer wants to be something other than a lawyer. And I'm back in the very fortunate position where I'm very glad and want to be a lawyer again because, you know, nearly having it all taken away from me through my own sort of stupidity, if you like. Well, not if you like. Reality was that it was a lot of stupid behaviour. I sort of love being a lawyer. I love being back doing it again.
So the firm's up for sale. It sells.
Yep.
I believe one of the highest... Selling law firms at the time.
At the time, there'd been a couple of other really big floats of law firms. And the firm that we sold the business to went on to massive, massive money in you know, on a share market value, but it all collapsed and they basically lost everything. But for us at the time, it was, you know, the biggest sale that had ever happened. And we were certainly, you know, got a lot of media attention through that. But, you know, it was one of those things, I think, where looking back on it, what seemed at the time like the best thing that could have happened to me was probably the worst.
Because
it really took away my identity, it took away my purpose, and it took me totally away from the group of people that I'd been so closely aligned with. And it was a big void when I left. You know, I really noticed, and a lot of people, you hear a lot of people that sort of chasing this success and got a clear focus, and you get there, and when it happens, you go in a heap.
It's funny you say that. We've had this conversation here on the Clink before, and I can relate to it too with some of my own achievements. You put so much into something, and you work extremely hard to be the best at what you can be. And once you succeed there or you hit that pinnacle, there's a downside. Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. Barry Hall was one that spoke about, you know, being one of the greatest AFL players of all time, you know, to finishing up and looking around and going, what now? And he had a downward spiral because, you know, most... about 80% of his life was structured around him being a successful athlete. And you're talking about that same sort of structure within business.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it was one of those situations where, and mine was more complex than that because I went from being, you know, a successful guy in a very successful, well-known business, sold it, and that, you know, great job, and you've had this huge win, and it seemed like all the money in the world, but a lot of the time too, it just isn't. Like I was making a lot of money and I was, you know, developing a lot of assets and stuff like that. And then for the single check to come, I sort of thought, shit, this will be enough to last me five lifetimes. And I think in reality, it lasted me about 3 years and I'd burned through the lot. You know?
How much was it, Nigel?
Well, I was divorced sort of around the time that it all happened. So thank goodness, you know, I could only lose half.
A little bit of something still for the kids.
So, and then basically what happened was that, you know, I'd sort of transitioned. I thought that I wanted to be a farmer. I was going to get out of law and I was going to go off and be a farmer, which I was spectacularly unsuccessful. So a lot of the money went into that. And then there was tax and there was all these other things. You just don't get what you think you would get.
But still in the millions, many millions.
Yeah, I had millions of dollars, millions and millions of dollars. And then basically what happened was that, you know, through circumstances of my partner at the time, a new partner, you know, that I was took up with, and that, in you know, through that relationship that introduced a lot of people that I just had no business being around, and, you know, behaviour around me that became normalised because, you know, I'd never really had any exposure to drugs or anything like that. And then all of a sudden... it's around me and I've lost my association with all my law firm people and I'm out in the middle of nowhere and all of a sudden the void that's been created, because they all just kept on going. We sold the business and left. All my mates, my brother, my cousin, everyone stayed involved, but I was gone. And I suppose that void was filled with people that, and what became normal just should never have become normal for me.
What made you successful in law?
I think that I'm blessed with a, you know, serious, serious drive. Like I've done some personality tests, and in fact, one of the things about coming back to being a lawyer, I had to do an ethics course, which will be interesting, and I've got some stuff happening on that tomorrow. But one of the things there was that you had to do a personality test, And, you know, what it showed to me was I was like 99 out of 100 for drive and ambition. And I'm very driven towards building, making things bigger. But I have a weakness about making sure they stay good and work on, you know. So you sort of need somebody like I'm, you know, 10 Nigels put into a business together will be this roaring success and will be bankrupt a year later. You need a couple of blokes that are sort of going to...
If you put that into perspective, that Nigel would have been the man that received all this money with all these big ideas and wants and beliefs of what was going to happen.
Yeah.
But as you said, there comes a big hole. And there was no one around you.
No.
Nobody there to structurally help you with your ideas, your visions.
Yeah, so I think more what happened was that the void that was created when I left that sort of world that I'd been in was filled up with people that... And, you know, you say about you are the people that you hang around with. And nothing could have been more the truth. You know, I went from hanging around my mates who were all sort of solicitors and lawyers working for me or people that we knew through that industry. And then next thing I know, they're all gone and all the people that I'm hanging around with are all drug dealers and crooks.
How did you get into that scene from being such a successful man? Like
I think the way that it happened was that I sort of lost my way. And, you know, and I don't blame anyone other than myself, like, but I lost my way. And it's funny how when you start doing things that are contrary to your moral compass, you only need to deviate a little bit and you end up a long, long way from where you ever would be. And I suppose I just allowed things to be around me initially that I wasn't participating in, but I had no business being around. And that was a weakness on my part. I should have just said, no, I'm out of here, that's that.
Yeah.
But then one thing becomes the next thing becomes the next thing. You become more and more entrenched. And what should have been sort of shocking behaviour to me just became very normal.
Speaking of normal, and we touched on, as you just said, being around drugs. And myself, I was convicted to 6 years for commercial importation. So definitely no stranger to that conversation.
Yep.
You got arrested.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, well, what happened was there was a, I suppose the day that I was arrested was the culmination of a year of basically where I sort of started out, I can remember it was Christmas time 2011 was the first time that I ever tried ice. And ice had been around me for a number of years, 5-6 years. It had been in the household, it had been around,
right,
but I'd never participated.
Okay.
And so what happened was there was just a sort of like a series of different things that all culminated to me going from being somebody who'd been around it to actually using it. And, you know, I've said before that what happened was that, you know, the circumstances were such that I tried it one time and I thought, oh, shit, you know, how long has that been going on? And I just found that, like, oh, okay, I'm going to... I had it. The reason why I had it was a bit weird, but I was basically had a lot of work to do, and I was like, I need to stay awake. I had all this fun.
Mate, it's a lot of professional tournament. They get on the coke and lose track of where they are, but they get on the pipe, and next minute they're zoned, focused, and everything's going accordingly.
Yeah, and so what happened with me was that I sort of had it, and I intended to just have it for this one weekend, and then I was not going
to
have it again.
Just to get you through it.
And then I thought, shit, that was all right, you know. And it made me, you know, it made me feel fantastic. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just have it for this week and then I'll stop at the end of the week. And then basically what started out in November 2011 was meant to stop. You know, okay, I'm going to stop by Christmas. I would definitely not go into next year. No way, no way. Oh, I got this under control, you know. And
did anybody else know that you were falling into this hole?
Yeah,
was it somebody?
Not many people. No,
it was,
not many
you were
people.
Quite dark.
Very
about
much
it.
A secret. You know?
Absolutely.
And you know, and so what happened then was it was sort of like progressively. And the funny thing about that drug was that for the first few months, I was killing it. You know, like I was sort of like, I was at work, I was working at home. I feel like, okay, I'm going to do all these things and I get all this stuff done, and I was losing weight and I felt fantastic. And, you know, it's sort of like, reminds me of that show Limitless, you know, the movie, you know, everything's fantastic.
Yep.
Then you burn out. And next thing you know, you're meant to be somewhere and you're waking up and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon and what the hell, you know, or you're starting to sort of look out the windows because you're sure the light up the road wasn't there. It's not normally there. And, you know, all the, everything that happens, that hearing, the you know, the auditory hallucinations, the whole bit. And it just got worse and worse and worse. But the I suppose the getting arrested thing was that there was this fellow in the house who was the is the ex-partner, and he was the father of my stepson. And you know, he was there, and he was sort of not long out of jail, and it was going to be like, oh, he's going to do all these things to us, and if we pushed him away, it was bad, but if he was close, it was sort of safe, and it was this sort of situation.
Yeah,
and,
I get it.
Yep. And then, of course, you know, I was sort of concerned about what was going to happen, and I had kids there, and kids coming and going, and so basically what happened was, it was like, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. But what I didn't know was that for the whole time that he was out of jail, because he was a very, very well-known crook, you know, he was under surveillance. So what's happening is they're surveilling him, and they're watching him and all of his mates that are sort of trying to get this drug dealing thing going, and a big drug import that they had planned to do. And in the meantime, you got the lawyer driving down to Boondall to buy drugs to bring back to use with his partner. And they're like, what the hell, you know? And so for a whole year, as I got worse and worse and worse and worse, everything's being recorded. There was eight.
In the house as well.
The house, the cars, the phones, everything.
So completely off.
Yeah, and so what happened was then, it was funny because, like, there were things happening that were just weird, and I'm like, what the hell would happen there? Like, I'd be speeding in my car, and I'd get pulled over, and, you know, I'm going to get the book thrown at me. And they'd go back to the car, and then they'd come back and say, oh, no, you're right to go. And I'm like, what the hell? Mm. And I was like, you know, and look back on it now, and I think, well, they were watching me. Yeah. They didn't want to interrupt the thing, and blah, 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 you know. So what happened was, you know, I'd go down the road. And the funny thing was, I was such a naive drug user. It was embarrassing. Like, I think if you were going to be a drug customer, and if you get me as a customer, if you're going to be a drug dealer and you get me as a customer, you're home. Like, I'd walk in and say, oh, can I have $500 worth? I wouldn't even know, didn't know what a point was or this
you
or that.
You had lump sum of cash.
I'd just go and say, here's $1,000. Can I have $1,000 worth?
And that'll get you through whatever. And
yeah, and then I'd use that. And then a few days later, can I have this and of this? And it was just bloody hopeless. But what ended up happening was, so there was the sort of the primary people that were involved in this business that was going on, and then they're driving my utes, they're doing this, they're doing that.
And so they're all registered in your name?
Yeah, and everything was considered that I was the big guy in the middle.
So you were basically associated principal.
Yeah, and so I was never really, and even when I ended up getting convicted, I was convicted of being a drug trafficker, but not because I was doing it myself, but because I was a party to what they were doing.
So as the law states with group enterprise, basically, you know, like the driver sits in the driver's seat, robs the bank and pulls the trigger, well, you're getting done with the gun and the robbery as well as the car.
Yeah, and what happened there? And, you know, and there was a couple of discrete things that I did do that got me in all the trouble. But, you know, they were on record of something like 150 occasions that I'd supplied, but the 150 occasions were driving down, going to the same place, buying from the same person, coming back, using it, go then, you know, day or two later, come back, go again. And it wasn't, you know, so it was different to that. But, you know, they had me caught up in all that, and there was, you know, 10,000 phone calls transcribed, and it was crazy.
In a Queensland suburb, cops are raiding a suspected dealer's home.
Police search warrant!
And so the day I was arrested, 6 o'clock in the morning, I could not wake up. It's getting shaken. There's just a room full of police. And it was crazy, you know.
You had no idea that was going to happen.
Had no idea it was going to happen. But what had happened was the guy that was in the centre of it all, he was leaving. There'd been issues, and he was finally going to move out and come live down the coast here. And so we're like, you know, that's the end of that chapter. And it was, you know, I was really excited that was going to happen. But what ended up happening was, you know, they turned up, and he's been arrested. He's in handcuffs. And I'm like, okay, well, this is right. And I'm saying, hey, I've got to go to court, I've got to go to place. And they're, no, you can't leave. Anyway, they gave me this whole heap of paperwork, and so there was paperwork relating to federal police, and there was paperwork relating to state police. Anyway, so I grabbed the federal police warrant, and I read through it, and at the back of it was this big, long list of all these different people, and I'm looking and looking and looking and looking, and I didn't see my name. I was like, oh, good, you know, doesn't involve me, that's fine. And I sat down. I remember we were just sitting and waiting, and they were processing this bloke. And then I just happened to sort of see another warrant, and it had a state-based one. And I picked it up, and I nearly died. It had Nigel Munt trafficking, and I was like, what the hell is this, you know? Fuck. And I had no idea. And then I said, like, you know, this is bullshit. How am I involved in this, you know? But it was, I think what happened was that at the time there was this belief that I was more involved than I actually was. And it came out in the end that, you know, my involvement was very, very minor in that bigger operation, which was...
I seen it in the media, I think. What did you have? 17 charges, was it? Or 19 charges?
Well, I ended up getting charged with 23 charges. You know, they basically just picked, they're going to charge you with that. But it was trafficking in the methamphetamine, and then there was about 23 supplies. But they just picked 23. It could have been 100.
And that's the thing, too. You know, like I remember my case, it was... the backup charges were supply. I was like, well, fuck, who have I supplied it to?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I haven't even had a chance. But they were adamant because of the I was federal as well, and then it went to state, and it was the state backup charges.
Yeah.
And the reality is a lot of them do drop off as you go through the process, but, you know, the ones that they want to stick generally cost us. Yeah. So here you are, a successful lawyer. Well, now a member with a nice addiction and a criminal record.
It was terrible.
You couldn't get much higher than murder or something like that. Like, you were fucked.
No, I mean, I can remember that day that I got arrested.
Yeah.
And I was just, like, in a state of complete, you know, and I mean, looking back on it, I probably shouldn't have been in a state of disbelief, but I was. You know, I just could not believe that this was happening. Mate, I was suicidal. I just was beyond myself. Couldn't work out what the hell was happening.
What was it like, Nigel? Like, you know, I mean, looking back now, obviously at the time, you don't realise you've got a problem. You know there's an issue, but it's not how an addict thinks.
No,
you know,
but I mean, I was
how
really...
How was it for someone like you to all of a sudden have this addiction of ice?
I mean, the funny thing was, I don't know who I was kidding to think that I could dabble in that when I'm probably have really always been an alcoholic. I'm addicted to all sorts of weird stuff. You know, I have this crazy addiction.
Personality.
Yeah, and then to think that I could dabble around with the most addictive thing going... you know, I don't know who I was kidding, but I really thought I could keep it under control, and I just couldn't. And I think then what happened was that life was so crazy otherwise that it was just a complete escape. It was like, okay, things might be shit, things might be terrible, all the rest of it, but if I have this drug for the next 10, 12, 15, 18 hours, I'm going to feel fantastic, and I'll worry about it after that. And it was just, that's where you get to, and I think that's probably the mentality that's so hard for these young kids that I come into contact with so often. You know, like, I did a lot of work after I got arrested. I did a lot of criminal work because I was allowed to up until I got convicted, and I found that really, really good for my recovery and for my sort of mental health, you know, return to form, if you like, was getting in and helping these kids that had had these problems. But, you know, I could just see it. Like, they get to the point where it's like, well, why wouldn't I use drugs? What else is there to do? You know, like, what's the point? And they get to that point in their life where they don't see that it's worth anything.
Ice is the perfect destructive drug. It's easy to make, highly addictive, and it's everywhere.
We know ice addiction destroys lives and nobody is immune.
I'm sitting here, and for you guys listening at the moment, I'm looking at a very well-dressed man.
Yeah.
You know, you're a grey-haired fellow, you know, quite distinguished gentleman. To me, I wouldn't walk past you, and look, there's people, and I don't want to sit here and start to, you know, actually sit here and stigmatise around what people look like.
No, you're right.
Mate, fuck.
Oh, mate.
It does not discriminate.
Yep.
A man of your caliber, your intelligence, your age, a family man, successful.
I mean, it was a strange time to start taking drugs at
age 41. And here you are, literally, you know, hanging out of the gutter.
It was terrible. Like, it was really, really bad. And you know, the thing about it was that I think when my QC stood up in court when we did the plea of guilty and it was all resolved, and he said, you know, if ever there was a case that could show that this can happen to anybody, this is it.
Just tell me, was it Mr. Vasta?
No, it was Jeff Onewood Hunter.
I do personally really have a lot of respect for Mr. Angelo Vasta.
Okay, yep.
QC I've had to use.
I've never really had much to do with him, but... I always used to joke with Jeff Hunter about his fees. You know, I say, look, you know, it's all right to kick off with the one wood, but you've got to get the chipper and the putter out occasionally. You don't need to keep hitting me with that.
Nah, mate, they like to drive it on down the fucking fairway, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and that was kind of the, I mean, that is the thing. He said, look, you know, if this could happen to anybody, if it could happen to this fellow, it could happen to anyone.
Absolutely.
And that is true. And, you know, and it's, I don't know, it really took a lot to shake me eventually anyway, because it took more than just getting charged for me to really say, shit, I've got stuff to lose here. I need to get back on track.
How did you deal with that? Because obviously it was a high-profile case, public interest.
Oh, terrible, yeah.
So, you know, once again, you're probably, well, just quote me if I'm wrong, you're coming down, you know, like you said, your mental health's gone, suicidal thoughts, bad, I'm sure, depression and really not seeing any light at the end of the tunnel at this stage, and everybody's looking down on you. You're just this fucking bloke that's just a piece of shit that sold fucking ice to people.
Mate,
and, you know, it's going back, you know, 20 years ago, it was like heroin. You know, and
Terrible.
That was a terrible era there when there's an epidemic. Now we have that ice epidemic and you're in the thick of it.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that. How did Nigel find that? And then what does Nigel do to get through that?
It was an interesting little period because the media that I got was, here's a bloke who sold a business and got $20-odd million, and 18 months later, he's selling ice to people.
Yeah.
And it just...
What a headline.
And it just smacked of either this bloke is such a greedy pig, or there's something more to the story. And I tell you that people generally are pretty good. You know what I mean? Like, I was really humbled and flattered, I suppose, by a lot of support that I got from people that, you know, I may not have expected to get support from. And they said, there's more to that story than meets the eye. You know what I mean? And there was. And eventually that's what came out. And eventually the more than what meets the eye is what saved me from going to actual jail and, you know, and gave me a chance to redeem myself and get back to doing what I love to do.
What was your actual sentence?
I got a 4 years, 4 years suspended. For 3 years wholly suspended for 4 years.
And you lost, obviously, any license?
No, what happened was, it was really interesting because I got arrested in August 2012, but because the wheels turned so slowly, I was able to keep being a lawyer up until when I got convicted. So
really?
From the time I got arrested, and what happened, which was really good, was I went to you have to disclose, if you get charged with a serious criminal offence as a lawyer, you have to disclose it to the Law Society within a week or 2 weeks or whatever it is. So I did that. And then they said, well, look, we're going to let you keep practising subject to conditions. And those conditions were a drug test every week. And I had to get cleared off by my psychiatrist that I was a safe bet to be doing legal work. Anyway, so that was easy. And that part of it was fine. But then with the drug test every week, if you're the one who's providing the drug test every week and you know when the test is, it's, you know, you can sort of...
Did you fuck up?
A few times, you know, and I didn't fuck up. I never gave a positive drug test.
People on parole don't give positive drug tests when they know they've got a couple of days to flush either.
But I tell you what I did do. What I did do was, because I knew that I needed to get my life back on track. I had too much to lose. I had children to worry about. And, you know, I just didn't want to... in that way. So
if I can just ask you, I mean, you just mentioned children.
Yeah.
As a father who's, you know, had to have children that have seen their dad in jail and they know everything about my history.
Yep.
How was it for your children?
Oh, it was pretty tough on my elder girls. I've got two lots of children. I've got three elder daughters. And they were in mid-high school when it happened.
Sure.
And, you know, they got a bit of flack about it. And then the little ones, I think, were just oblivious to it. They didn't know what was going on. It was their mother that was involved with me in that at the stage all this happened.
Was there an ongoing support for Dad? Dad, you know, beside you the whole way?
There was a lot of support, and it was funny, you know, the thing that really, the single thing that really made me get my shit together, I sort of tried to do a few things to help myself. So I said, okay, well, if I can do a drug test once a week, that's going to allow me to dabble. If I wanted to dabble or if I made a stupid decision or whatever, that's going to allow me to dabble. So what I did was, I got the Law Society to increase the frequency of the drug test that I had to give them to twice a week. That meant I could not possibly use and do clean
tests. Smart
move,
mate. Well,
so I did that, and that was sort of something. But then what happened was I had a period where I kind of had like a little mini intervention with my mum, and I'd sort of reconnected with the kids' mother, and we'd used, and it was, and you know, and I wanted to get home, and it was just this crazy shit going on. And my mum was at my house, and she was there helping me with all the kids because we were estranged. So I had these five kids that I'm trying to look after.
Your partner was also using.
Yeah, big history of it.
And really?
That was kind of the introduction.
Did you know that when you got
together? No, I didn't know when I got together with her. No, and I found out later, and in too deep, and you know, one of those things. Yeah, and man, again, it was like, hey, I should have run a mile, but I didn't, and you know, that's that. But what happened was my mum said, look, you know, and it was obvious. I turned up and I looked shit. You know, I looked a mess, and my mum just said, listen. Took me out to the, there was a little park next to that rental house that I was living in by this stage, and took me over to the park and just said, you got a decision to make right this second. If I leave here today and I don't think that you're on track to get treated and get this shit sorted out, you will never see us again ever. And this is it. There's no second choice, no second chance. If you want help, I'll stay, and I'll stay here with you and make sure you get on the right track. And that is the minute in my life where everything turned
very
around again.
Very powerful,
yeah,
isn't it?
And it was. And it was, and that's what it was. And it was the support of my mum that said, you know, I'm going to leave your life right now because we don't want to watch this shit anymore. We're sick of it. But I'll help you if you want help. And that was, you know, she stayed. We booked an appointment. I met a cool psychiatrist who's, you know, good bloke. And I've really had a lot of support from him. And that, which really helped a lot. And that was the turning point. And then from then, I really kind of just said, right, I have to just cut these ties. And, yeah, and things have gone on real
well. Did you put yourself into rehab at all? Did you go through withdrawals?
I went for a couple of weeks to rehab. But
mum and that. I mean, like, talk to us about, for people that don't understand how powerful this drug is.
I think the thing that's really powerful is...
What's the come down of it?
Well, the thing about, okay, so if you come off it, so, like, for me, I was basically at a stage where I had to have it in the morning to function, or I could not function. So it was, you're basically on it to go, and you're off, and you're on something else to
completely
stop.
Completely controlled you.
Yeah, so you couldn't.
So even though it was an up, it has the same sort of the same stronghold as heroin.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because well, I mean, I've known a lot of addicts in my time, and I've been around them, and they couldn't function without that shot.
I don't know much about heroin, but all I know is that I think there's a different physical dependence.
Sure.
I think ice and heroin are different physical dependence, but it becomes very situationally, like, you know, you start to imagine not being able to do things unless you had it. And, you know, like, my ex-partner would be unable to do chores or do housework or do anything without it.
Wow.
And you just become... And I was at that stage where, like, even the day the coppers came and arrested us, I was like, oh, man, if I would do anything to just go into that bathroom and have some, because I had some in there, I need some to get going. I'm like, I was like a zombie. I could not start. And that's where I'd gotten to. And
were you taking like Xannies and tablets as well, just
not
to switch
huge
you
amount.
Off?
I just crashed, you know. I'd just be awake for a while, then I'd crash. But you get so ratty because you get no decent sleep and you become paranoid and just every bad thing about it I was getting. And, you know, so that was that. So what then happened was because I was given the, you know, and I appreciate it to this day, I was given the ability to keep being a lawyer while I waited to be dealt with through the court. Because, you know, there's the presumption of innocence. I was showing that I was abstaining from the drugs. My psychiatrist said I wasn't a risk to anyone. And away I went. And then what happened was I spent that next, it took like 3.5 years between getting, or about 3 years between getting arrested and having it finalised. So just the shame and, you know, everywhere you went, you thought everyone was talking about you, and I'm sure they probably were.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, the law is a bitchy sort of industry, you know, a lot of, like, backstabbing and bloody gossip and all the rest of it. And, you know, so I just had to sort of man up and do what I was doing. But I really did find that period that I worked, and I did a lot of criminal work in that period, while it was a weird thing to be turning up to these courts thinking, shit, I'll be here soon enough, you know, but helping people. And I really found that helping, you know, and I mean, I would
have regularly... you done criminal law, have you?
No, I started doing it because when I left, when I sort of, I started a business, and it was the business we were running was, we would do criminal work for people just so you'd get a bit of cash flow going. And then we'd primarily want to do accident claims. Yep. Accident claims is what I've always really done. But I did do a fair bit of criminal work in that period between when I was charged and when I was sentenced. And that was probably the thing that I was most disappointed about, was when I was sentenced and didn't go to jail. Well, obviously, I was delighted and very relieved and hugely, you know, huge grateful. But then what happened was the law, because of the convictions, they took my practicing certificate away. Mm. And that meant that I couldn't do any more of the criminal work, which is, yeah, I was a bit disappointed about that. And then what happened was I then struck a deal with the Law Society where they said, look, you know, they cancelled my practising certificate. They allowed me to work for a law firm. So I was working for this firm that we'd set up.
So you weren't able to be a senior...
I couldn't be a lawyer.
Contributor?
No, but I could...
you could work under the supervision.
Yep.
Am I using the right terms here?
So basically what happened was I couldn't be a solicitor, but I could be a clerk. So,
okay,
you know, if you
like
imagine...
a paralegal sort
of
thing.
Yeah, paralegal. And so what I could do is help people, and that was good, but it meant that I couldn't do court appearances and I couldn't do that sort of stuff. And then what happened was I struck a deal with the Law Society that I wouldn't apply for a certain period of time and that they would... allow me to work, because they have to get their permission to allow you to work. You know, you can't employ somebody with a criminal record.
Is that like going back to court again and sitting there with three judges in front of you determining on whether or not you're
fit and proper,
you know,
and
fit
all
and
that.
Proper to be able to, like, are you, like, is it back on the sort of
that
sort of feeling again, well, where you're going to be judged?
It's then a question, a lot of judging after that, and then it's a question of sort of going through and saying, well, okay, how did it come to pass? Look at other factors, you know, what other things you've done, the circumstances, the offending, and you know, I mean, to be honest with you, I lost more money between when I got arrested and when I eventually went to court, and I don't mean paying my lawyers, I lost more money after I was arrested than I'd lost up to it.
Just why people just not wanting to have you in practice?
Mate, just, no, because I think what happened was I had such a doom and gloom outlook about where I was heading in life. I wasn't going to be able to be a lawyer. I'm not going to be able to make the money that I make. And then I started gambling. And what I think happens is people smell blood in the water. You know what I mean? So you have this sort of big, this bloke with still had plenty of money, had all these other things, and all these people are going to help you, and they're going to help you. And all they do is help you out of a lot of money. And I look back and, you know, I was in crazy ventures and I was just hard gambling. I was just gambling on this is going to work, this is going to work, this is going to work. And
so gambling as in gambling casinos?
No,
sort of gambling,
no. Gambling as in...
project gambling.
Project.
Investing
this
money.
This is going to be a great...
Yeah, right.
This is going to be a great app. We're going to do this app and we're going to do this and we're going to do that and we punt money.
Which is hundreds of thousands
and
of dollars.
And we're going to punt this, we're going to punt that. And just stupid, dumb things. Like, and looking back on it now, I think, what was I thinking? But I know what I was thinking. I was thinking... I'm going to lose my ability to make a living. I'm not going to be able to afford to look after my kids. I'm not going to be able to feed myself.
So if you're creating something here that's going to work for itself,
and if I throw,
there's a residual in turnover.
So I throw seven different things all going and hoping one of them will hit.
Yep.
And you know, sure enough, seven out of seven didn't, and that was the end of my money.
Wow.
Anyway, and then what happened was, because then I got convicted, I then got charged by the Legal Services Commission for unprofessional or professional misconduct because I was a convicted
drug
trafficker.
How does that work?
Well, what happens is, if you're a lawyer, you basically get hit three times. Mm. The police charge you and you go through and you deal with that punishment or that outcome. Then the Law Society say, well, hang on, we've issued you with a legal practicing certificate here. We're taking it off you because we don't believe you're a fit and proper person. That's the second part of it, which you got to deal with. Then the third one is, hey, you know what? Being a convicted drug trafficker is, and I don't, no one would disagree, at least unprofessional or professional misconduct. So you get charged for that. So the charge is that you got convicted. And so what happened then was I had the Legal Services Commission charge me for unprofessional conduct, which we pleaded guilty to, because how could we not say that it was 100% it was professional misconduct to be involved in that. I had no problem with that.
One thing you do when you go to the bar is to swear on oath that you would not associate yourself with this type of way of life.
Yeah, and then what happened was, and again, I've just been very fortunate. I had a court case about whether or not I would lose my practicing certificate forever, because the choice was either we take it away and you're never ever to be a lawyer again, or we say, look at the offending and the nature of it and say, well, it was really, you know, if there was no drug use and no drug dependence and none of that, you know, is the behaviour drug related or is it inherent crook behaviour? And I was very lucky that they said, okay,
there's no criminality behind it as such.
You know, and it was, well, and it just meant that if you could sort of deal with your substance issues and all the rest of it, you weren't inherently no good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And so basically then what happened was they said, okay, after 5 years, you're allowed to get your practicing certificate back. So that was this year. So for the last few months, I've been back doing it again, and mate, you know, loving it. So
and we'll get it into that because I really want to. That's you know your story of redemption, which is a very very big part of the Clink podcast.
Yeah.
You talk about the years in between, though. There must have been some tough times.
And, it was. Yeah.
You know, like I can't imagine all the money was there that you would have probably wanted or needed to.
Oh no, I had
fill in
tough
those times.
Mate, I was borrowing money off my. You know,
talk
I mean,
us through how well, that went for you, mate.
I had some really lean periods where I was completely penniless. I had no money, and I had no money to pay my rent. I was borrowing money off my mum and dad, and that's
did you
where
often
I got to
sit there, but Nigel, and ponder on how the fuck you got to being broke from
only every day,
you know, being a part of, you know, one of the biggest in your time exchanges in money, you know, I mean, when it comes to purchase of a law firm.
Yeah, look, you know, I've been through such a journey of that, and, you know, you learn things that, you know, mate, I could sit around today and say, look, you know, you could just have regret, but sooner or later, you've just got to say, hey, all the decisions that happen, all the failures and all the losses are mine. And I can either sit around and feel sorry for myself or not take myself too seriously and have another crack. And that's what I'm loving is having another go, you know.
I'm going to touch on that with you because I think it's very important what you've just said then. Often I've been asked, you know, like, oh, you know, do you regret this in certain interviews and things? And my one answer to that is, and I'll say it again, and I'm probably say it for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be here right now with you having this conversation, delivering your story of redemption to these thousands of people out here whom I hope that helps somebody else out there.
Oh, I do too, 100%.
You know, we wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
So look at regret, look at life and go back and say, well, fuck, I should have, could have, would have. Yeah, definitely there's things there that happened that, like I missed out on seeing my child born, you know, like I lost a home. Mm. Mate, there are a lot of things that I've never come back from, things I can't change. Do I regret it? Well, mate, I don't say the word I regret it, no.
No, I think it's a dead energy.
It really is, you know, and I think that we can often sit back and ponder on these sort of things, and if anything, it's probably good because it then gives you a bit of a smack in the head again and puts you back in perspective and you start to go, well, fuck, hang on. I've been right at the bottom.
Yeah.
I've literally eaten shit off the ground, you know, and look where I am now.
Mate, there's a, I remember a conversation I had with a really good mate of mine, and this is a guy that's known me since I was about 19. Saw the whole journey, the whole up, the whole down, the whole everything.
Hard for him?
Great bloke. Just a good guy, you know. Mm. And he's mad keen on the Navy and all this, and I've got a great-grandfather. My great-grandfather was a bloke who was a Norwegian sailor, and he left home at 15 because they arranged a wife for him and he didn't want to know about it. He left home and he never went back, and his entire life is just this crazy adventure that ended with him having 8 kids here in Queensland.
So nomadic, basically. Just
last kid at 68, was the sole survivor of shipwrecks, wrote a book about this thick, which was the whole journey of his life. And then one of my great aunties became a fundamental Christian and got the book. And every single page that had swearing on it, which was 99 out of 100, she threw away and burnt because she didn't want the blasphemy.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, so, but my mate says, you are Captain Ingerman, Nigel. You are your great-grandfather.
It's jumped the generations.
This is the crazy adventure you live. Your life is just a crazy adventure. And, mate, you know what? It's funny you think of one little conversation and, you know, you talk about this, are you okay or this or that. You can have one conversation with one person that can re-trigger their belief or just give them that little shot of confidence. And I go back to that day, I know exactly where I was sitting. We were sitting at a restaurant we always used to go to. We're always laughing and taking the piss out of each other. And he said, mate, you're Captain Ingerman. He said, you will look back on this. This is not the end of it. You're not over. This is a blip. You'll be through it. And I didn't believe him. I just said, no, you know, I was basically more or less saying to him, like, why would I not just kill myself?
I know, mate, I'm cuffed. On the ground, pitch black, you know, GPs in my head, guns to my head. And they're telling me I'm looking at 20 years plus and, you know, I'm in a controlled delivery.
Yep.
Mate, I don't know what they assume they knew, what they didn't know. I had to sit in fucking custody and, you know, wait for the police brief. In the end of the day, it came down to about 10 years, which ended up being 6 from an early guilty plea. But there were times there where I thought, this is it.
Yeah, it's no point.
There's no point. My wife was, you know, 4 or 4.5 months pregnant. I wasn't coming home.
Yeah.
And as far as I was concerned, The only thing I was looking at was four walls and bars.
Yeah.
Why the fuck would you want to do it? But, and there is light at the end of the tunnel. And I think, you know, just what you said, Dan, is very valid to a lot of people out there that probably are in similar situations to what we've both been in.
Yeah.
And some not so much, some a lot worse.
Yeah.
And I think it's very powerful to remind people that, you know, like here you are sitting here and, yeah, and you're mate, talking about...
I've had some crazy, fun, mad adventures.
Heavy times.
Yeah, and but you know, you look back on it and you think, okay, I don't know. I said, it's funny. I said to one of the partners that I was with in those big businesses, you know, and we were laughing about, you know, he's chasing the dollies, like squillionaire, unbelievable squillionaire. And, you know, and I said, oh, mate, you want to do what I do? Just get rid of the lot and then have the fun of going again. And, you know, there is an element of that. Like, I love doing what I do. You know, like I've got great mates. I've got blokes like Willem and Jackson and these other fellas who help, you know, spruik me out there. And I, you know, I just love doing stuff for people. I love doing what I do. And I think probably what I've gotten to the point now is where I actually really, really appreciate what I do.
Appreciation. You know what? That's a really powerful word again. I think you can count all the millions. You can travel the world. You can sit at the table with who you think's the best of the best. Snort your rack, drink your piss, smoke your pipe, whatever you want to do, and think you're the king of the fucking mountain. But at the end of the day, simplicity is the key to success. If you can't just be humble and happy with you know, a wage that provides for you and your family, gives you a little bit more here and there, and allows you to do, you know, a few little extra things.
Yep.
You're never truly going to be happy, even if you did have $1 million.
Yeah, yeah.
If anything, you're mate, destined for failure.
That's so true. Like, I look back and I remember clearly sitting there thinking, okay, this is my lot in life. I'm talking before any of this trouble, any of this. And I remember thinking, you know, shit, you know, if you sat there and objectively thought about it, I'm so really, really doing well, and I'm so well off. But I never, ever appreciated it. I never thought I was that well off. I never was happy. I was just, I'm never happy. And funny thing is now I sort of roll myself through. I've been through all that crazy shit. I'm way happier now than I ever was with not a skerrick of what I used to have. But
isn't
I love doing what I do.
Isn't it amazing, though? That's
it
right.
Is, yeah.
You're loving what you do.
And, mate, I look back, too, and I think that, like, you know, I even said, like, I know the main copper that arrested me is a bloke called Nigel, you know, and I remember in the back of the car we were driving into the city and they kept saying, the copper's in the car going, hey, Nigel, I'm, yeah, what? You know, they were talking to him. But anyway, and like he said, mate, we saved you. Like, we saved you from this fucked up situation that you were in. And I go as far as to say I reckon that that's true, you know.
Yeah, I fucking agree because I've said it in my podcast before. Had I not got caught... and being given those years in jail to reflect, know what loss was, realise how serious life is good and can be, I would have been dead or doing life, you know, if that hadn't happened.
Yep.
I've no doubt you would have been in the same space.
Yeah.
You know, curled up somewhere with a bullet in you or something from someone that was off their head, or you got into conflict with another addict that was coming down. Whatever it might be, when you're involved in that world, mate, it is erratic. Anybody at any stage can just click.
Oh, yeah.
And it's the drugs that turn that person to become that way. You don't trust anyone?
No.
There's no friends.
No.
So you're vulnerable. They're all stages.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and yes, no doubt, mate, you're here and saved because of your fuck-up.
Yeah.
I know I am.
Yeah. And, mate, I even took it a step further. I think, you know, it sort of was like, okay, to the point where I kind of realised that my alcohol use was off the charts before I you know, went on to drugs. But it was.
Did
just
you stop drinking when you were using? Or
no,
did you
I just drank the whole time. Like I, you know, the funny thing is, I sit here now and I never drink alcohol. I haven't drunk alcohol for years. Although, you know, Willem's bringing out his new beer. I was joking. It'll be such a beautiful drop.
Can you imagine that?
It'd be a rough go.
The thrusting fucking pelvis froth.
You know, so I think I'll even you know, resist the massive temptation to try that. But what I say is,
just
like, you know,
the rim.
Mate, but you know, it's like I just sort of look at it now and I think, okay, I had anxiety through the roof, which led to workaholic behaviour, led to crazy little sort of things that would take my mind off it. So if I was really busy, I wasn't anxious. I really strong suffer of anxiety. I just was a great solution to anxiety.
Really?
Oh, I found it was. You know, like, it makes you paranoid and all the rest of it, but, you know, it's like as high as you go, whatever fun you have here, you owe, and you're going to pay back. And I sort of feel that way with alcohol. Like, I don't drink, not because I'm completely loose if I do, which I am, and it's unfortunate, but I just find that
at least you can sit here and admit that.
Yeah, but if I drink,
right there is,
yeah, but if
really
I drink,
strong.
I get really anxious. You know, pack your bags, we're going on a guilt trip. I get really, really. So I just choose not to, and that's another thing that through all this shit, I've kind of thought, okay, this is how I'm going to live my life. I don't drink alcohol because it'll make me anxious, and I don't want to feel anxious. I hate that feeling, you know.
Do you take CBD?
No, I've tried it a bit, but I've never really had sort of like regularly. I probably
mate, go and see
help.
A doctor.
Yeah.
I'm serious. I take non-THC in the morning. I'm scripted.
Yep.
Medicinal cannabis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Scripted user. So, yep. You know, I'm happy to talk about it. And anybody that I come in contact with that tells me these sort of things, I live with type 2 bipolar.
Yep.
So my highs are highs and my lows are lows. Yeah, and yeah. I get on a push bike and ride across Australia.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like,
I was on a push bike, other was a motorbike.
Nah, fucking push bike, mate. 45 days. These motors with these two big legs. But I really like where you are at the moment. Like, I'm sitting here and I've just, that's the first time we've officially met.
Yep.
We've chatted on the phone a few times. And hearing your story, mate, it's very powerful. And I think that if somebody can take a leaf out of your book,
yep,
and know that, you know, no matter how high up you think you are,
oh yeah,
there will always be a downside, yep. You know. But the downside is it's about how you get back up from it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about now how you're getting back up.
Yeah. Okay.
From that.
Well, what I'm doing since I got my practicing certificate back, I sort of had a period where I kind of went off the air, and about a year, like I was doing a lot of videos with Jackson, and I had a good following on Snapchat and Instagram and all these sort of things. And I just kind of thought, no, I just want to stop doing all that. And I just want to basically...
So you become a bit of a socialite, an influencer.
Oh, mate, I was doing all that stuff and that was a lot
really?
Of fun. Yeah, it was crazy fun. You know, I had some videos, like I had videos... Well, I was in a lot of vlogs and stuff with Jackson, okay. And that was a lot of fun. You know, we sort of had this thing where I was his dad going...
Who's Jackson?
Jackson O'Doherty.
Yeah, don't know him.
Okay, well, he's a big social media influencer. Oh, you haven't heard of him? Yeah, he's a... Oh, he'll talk about anxiety. He'll be anxious now. Well,
yeah,
how's that
fuck.
Bloke not know me?
Oh, well.
But anyway.
Tell him to fucking throw some money my way or charity. All
but,
I see is him buying,
you know,
fucking fast cars and houses.
But anyway, so what I'm now doing is you know, and then basically what I now do is I've started this new brand at Aussie Injury Lawyers that we're playing around with. And that's
this is your own
well,
practice
again? Well, it's not really my practice because I'm employed by a firm, but, you know, we use it as a marketing tool, get the work in. And what I really like, the thing I like the best is, I talk, you know, Willem will do a swipe up for me and I'll talk to some young people that say, oh, look, you know, Nigel, I had this happen or that happen. And I'll say, look, have you ever spoken to a lawyer? No, I wouldn't really want to. But they'll ring me and they'll talk to me because they kind of know me. They know me from that, which is what I really love, you know. So I sort of talk to, I suppose, an audience of people that aren't going to engage with your typical mainstream law firm. And
yeah,
they're the
okay.
ones I want. And, mate, I'm talking, you know, situations where... 2-3 weeks ago, Willem did a swipe up. I spoke to a bloke who had a case going in New South Wales, and down there they have a threshold. You know, you've got to be over 15% to get anything, and it's really complicated. Anyway, and this kid says, oh, you know, I've got this thing going. I was at 23%, but now it looks like I'm 13, so you might get nothing. And I said, well, what about your super? What about your TPD insurance in your super? And he said, oh, what's that? Anyway, it turns out he had $480,000 cover, and we'll get that money for him. He didn't even know he had it. And that's my pet love. I love meeting people that don't know what they can do and helping them get the money. That's what we do. So,
no, I mean, look, that's a successful business right there.
Yeah,
and that's what life's about is, you know, being able to create something that's going to give you your comforts in life, pay your bills and a little bit of wealth. And it's doing okay for you?
Yeah, it's going really well, and we're just kicking that off. And, you know, we're getting a lot of traction. And you know, I have plans to sort of take that to who knows where. But, you know, I get a buzz out of doing it, so the more people that we can do it for, the better. It's really interesting, you know, like if you stand up in front of a group of people and you tell your story and you tell it warts and all and, you know, so much that we haven't spoken about, but tell the whole story. And it's like...
Mate, we're here all day. You can fucking open up. Tell me more.
So, you know, drop the jaw and, like, people are, what the hell? But, you know, I still have people who contact me and say, hey, do you remember you did a speech at da-da-da and I heard your story? And they connect with you. It's really good. And I've had a lot of feedback from when I went on Josh Wade's show, which is similar to this, and people that have still said, hey, you know. And, you know, I so even though I've sort of not done anything in a formal sense, which I would be very happy to do, I think on an informal basis, I kind of feel like I've had a lot of good conversations with people who reached out to me in similar situations and felt comfortable to talk to me because they didn't, you know, they said, hey, here's a guy that gets us and who's been through the same, you know?
That word you just said, gets us, you know, I've had the pleasure and the blessing over the years of being able to volunteer for some great organisations. The RISE program in particular is one that I'm very fond of that helps a lot of 15 to 16-year-old young men.
Yep.
And I usually go in there and mentor them for, you know, half a day. And they do a little bit of a backlog on who I am or who I was.
Yeah.
And I come in there and meet these young people. And, you know, it's funny. You walk in there and there's all these chests out, egos, you know. Little fucking gangster cunts, and you know, they're all fucking, yeah. Alpha's got the ciggy and he's pushing the old FTP. Little mate over here. Yeah, they don't give a fuck. By the end of it, I've got these young men embracing each other and a lot of time with tears in their eyes, realizing that they're all very similar.
Mm.
No one there is any bigger or better than the person next to them.
Yeah.
Circumstances, some of them are horrific, what they talk about. But having my experience to be able to share with them and make a difference. Even my podcast, I'm constantly getting connection from young people who now are a bit older because it had been, you know, over the last 4 to 5 years I've been giving my time to this organisation.
Yeah.
And they'll message me and say, hey, remember I was there, you know, I really want to say I love your podcast. I could really picture you
I'm keen
doing
to do
something
that,
like that because I think the way that the world is today and the epidemic within ICE itself, it's sad.
Yeah, it is.
It really is sad. And what's happening out there with domestic violence, mental health.
Oh, it's just huge.
Suicide.
It's huge.
You know, this drug is a very powerful drug. And I mean, a silly question, but a question I'm going to ask you. I mean, what would you tell young people? You know what I mean?
I think the best advice really is you just can never ever... Never once, you know what I mean? I lived that motto until I was 41 years old, and I wish I kept it because I would have saved myself an awful lot of grief. You know, you don't sit, you know, somebody who's never had a cigarette doesn't sit around thinking, God, I'd love a durry, you know what I mean? And if you just have that sort of thing, that is my rule, hard and fast. And I mean, that was the rule in my house. Like, my mum and dad would be, you can do anything you want to do, but don't ever come back and tell us that you've used drugs because you'll just get wiped. And that was the line in the sand that they had. And, I mean, I think that is the issue. But
was
then,
that very hard for your mum, being so moralistic and like that way, to then
it was,
sit down,
you know,
with her son and but say, this is the day you're going to either see the last of us?
To be honest with you, it was a drawn-out involvement because there was my partner was, you know, heavily involved in it, and that became, you know, that became known about. So there was sort of this constant battling trying to get her right, and she trying to get better and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, so it was sort of not like a complete shock, but then the fact that I was doing it was a complete shock. So, yeah, it was bad. And, I think that's the advice that I would give to young people. But then I also think you have to also deal with the people that have done it and want to stop doing it, where it's like you're not damaged goods, you know what I mean? Beyond this, you are still worthy, you can still do. Because, you know,
absolutely.
I think people get to the stage just like where, you know, I'm a piece of shit anyway, so what does it matter? So I'll just go and use again.
Yep,
absolutely. And that's the thing I think is that, like, I don't know, I just think that there's, and I mean, I get a buzz out of seeing these young kids because I know a lot of kids from, a lot of Logan people, a lot of kids from around Logan, and, you know, you see them and I knew them when they were running amok, you know, and now they've sort of, you know, there's one young bloke who I'm really good friends with who moved to Western Australia, and mate, he's a serious goal kicker, this kid, but he was loose, like they were out of control, like he was selling ice and he was just running amok. And now he's, you know, he's got a job. I think he got a job where 7,000 people applied for it, and he got the job. It's incredible.
Like, that's uplifting in itself.
He's a mad goal kicker. He really is.
You know,
good bloke.
To know that you've successfully achieved that.
Yeah, and like that's
thinking that you're
insane.
Just shit.
That is insane. But you know, he's
awesome.
And then I look at him and I think, well, shit, look at him now, and he's just killing it. Whereas the way he was heading, he was, you know, 10 years in jail.
Well, it was going to kill him, possibly.
100%. Yeah. So, but, Matt, I kind of think that, you know, like if you're in the fortunate situation that you never have tried it, for fuck's sake, stay in that situation. But if you have, and you know, I think that's the issue, is like, you're not, you know, you're not. Everyone can come back, you know what I mean? Everyone, it's never too late to say, oh, well, I'm shit anyway, because you're not shit anyway.
People talk about addiction, and your forever ongoing battle.
Yeah.
Being an addict.
Yeah.
You know, yes, sobriety, but are you, you know, an addict that lives
me
the rest of his life, or, yeah, is somebody
kind
who's,
of,
you know, is it always there, that temptation?
To be honest with you.
Do you truly feel that you could never, ever...
No, I mean, I'm
put in that scenario again.
I kind of think there's a few things. I'm so far, it for me, this seems so long ago.
Yeah.
It really does seem so long ago. And it's kind of almost weird. Like, I was driving down here today thinking, shit, I hope I can remember. You know what I mean? I hope I can remember all this stuff, because it really is such a long time ago. Yes. For me, it seems to be. And it seems to me to be like somebody else did it. I know the story, but it was not like, it's like it wasn't me, it was somebody else. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
But, you know, where was I going with that? I have made choices, not just, like, I mean, the thing about me is, like, I can quit stuff real well. Like, I've been addicted to, you know, crazy shit, and I quit everything and I can stop. But for me, like, I don't ever drink alcohol, not one sip ever. Because for me, it's easier to manage it that way. I can't drink a reasonable amount. If I drink, I'll drink every single day. If I drink, I'll drink every day.
Yep.
You know, what do they say? You know, one's too many and 100's not enough. That's me, you know. So for me, I just don't ever touch it. And the same again, like, I am now not having anything to do with anyone that is an ice user. Like,
so for, okay,
I know
for someone
them,
out
I
there that's listening,
I'm not hanging out with them.
For someone out there that's listening, Nigel, and I'm sure with the thousands of people that are tuning in,
yep,
there's got to be someone out there that this is really hitting home.
Yeah,
to.
For sure,
mate. What's some of the best advice you could give them in reference to, you know, taking themselves out of the picture, and how does one find that strength to step away and throw that fucking phone number and, you know, because
that's the killer.
We all say that, and it's a lonely road. Look, I was in bike clubs for, you know, the best part of 15 years. Mm. And not because I was no good, but I chose my life.
Yeah.
I done my time and what have you, and I don't have any, mate, I've got nothing but love for the boys. But unfortunately, with that and those years and years and years of having two phones running at the same time, always somewhere to go. I'm going to be here, I'm there, I'm busy. I've got church on fucking Friday night. We've got meeting. Man, I'm on a bender for 3 days. It all stops.
Yeah.
You have you.
Mm.
And you have to understand who you are and be okay with you, especially in the heart, the mind. And I think for me, the years of having that in jail, realizing that, fuck, I'm on my own. Besides my missus and kid,
this is not cool.
This is it.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to go deep within yourself to start asking the questions of how am I going to actually now live my life?
Yeah.
And how do you find that strength, like, from someone that, you know, like yourself?
Yeah, I mean,
what would you suggest to these people out there?
Oh, look, I think the nothing is truer than you are who you, you know, you are who you hang out with.
Yeah. Product of your own environment, I think, is the word.
And that's the issue. Is like, if you, you know, if you want to be a millionaire, hang out with millionaires. If you want to be you know, a bloody rock star, hanging out with rock stars, whatever it is. And that's just the fact.
Fuck, I've been hanging out with all these people for years.
Mate,
I'm still just a bloke from down the road.
You know, so I've been hanging out with legends, you know, obviously. Complete dead set legends.
Yeah, because you're cool.
But what I was going to say, though, was that, and that's
I'll
the
let
issue.
You pump yourself up there, mate.
So, you know, I mean, I'm sort of being back in that law thing for me is really cool because, you know, I knock around the young blokes who I work with and, you know, we have a lot of laughs. And I think probably I'm most addicted to laughing.
What about trust, Nigel? Especially in your line of work. How's that working for you now?
With trust?
Trust.
That's probably always been one of my weaknesses. I'm very fast to trust and, you know, I take everybody as being a good bloke and everybody's, you know, I see the good in everybody, whereas other people will sit back and sort of be a bit more cynical and a bit more. I think I've been probably a very, very unfortunate judge of character. You know, I think in one of the references in my court case, it was said that, you know, I collected waifs and strays, and I was always, you know, I always had a real soft heart for people, and I did. You know, so I don't know that. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm answering the question the way
no,
that
you're
it was
right.
asked.
But, I'm going to flip the coin in a minute. I'm going to ask you, what do you think people's opinions are of you now? Because knowing who you are and you're back practicing, well, is there a lot of trust out there for Nigel Munt and what Nigel Munt's doing and trying to achieve?
Oh, look, I think that, you know, I think that I've put a stain on my reputation that will never go away. And I think that amongst, particularly, say, the legal fraternity, there would be people who would just have no bar of me having anything to do with it.
Shame, really, isn't it? Because, well, you know, life is about redemption.
Yeah, but I'm not going to, you know, they can judge me and I'm, you know, and I get that. You know what I mean? And look, I'm that's not my style. I would not be like that. But at the end of the day, I get where they're coming from and I can see that, you know, and I mean, I, you know, and I'm not saying this, I genuinely am super, super, you know, grateful that I'm getting another chance to be involved. And, you know, I have no interest in fucking it up.
No.
But what I was going to say was that, you know, I can get that that's the case, but I also think that, that people that sort of know me, you know, I haven't really had issues with, you know, in the past I've got on with people, so I've been sort of fortunate like that. And
it blows me away. It really does. And as I said, you know, just before in our chat, you know, sitting here looking at you and, you know, just taking it all in. It's an amazing story, and I'm really honoured that I'm able to sit here and deliver this with you.
Cheers,
mate. To everybody out there listening. And, you know, it is a true story of redemption. It really is. And I would love, you know, to hear down the track that you're involved with something that, you know, off your own experience that's, that's probably giving back, because I truly feel that you have a lot of value there. Is there, and I ask this of all my guests, is there a motto, a line, a verse, a passage or something that resonates with you daily that you personally live by?
I kind of feel that I now know, I know what makes me tick and I deal with that. You know what I mean? I know that I have these tendencies and I just need to know that, you know, I know that there are certain things. And I'm kind of almost to the point where I think to myself, you know, just talk about, say, drinking. If I drink, my life will go shit, and I do it almost spiritually.
So you're conscious of this now?
Yep, I would do. I life is going good, and I don't want it to. I don't want it to take a bad turn. And I believe that whilst I sort of say, okay, that's one step that I can take. Every day I choose not to do that. It's not like I think about it, but I just choose not to drink again. And whilst I'm doing that, it'll go good, you know. So I sort of have those sort of mottos.
What about on the flip side of that? Everything falls apart again. Relationship's gone. You find yourself in a dark place again. You know, would Nigel, you know, and this is the hard thing. I know for myself, you know what I mean, with my bipolar. And if I get a bigger kick in the gut, sometimes I fold over and I'm a fighter. But, you know, I turn and do things and, you know, there's such things as relapses.
Look.
We all fuck up. I'm not going to sit here never, and play out that I'm a perfect person.
Oh, mate.
By any means.
I talk to people, you know, I talk to people every day who have faced some sort of a challenge, whether it's the death of a child. I mean, you know, we were involved in a case that we met somebody today who's, you know, who's seen her daughter killed and with, you know, multiple family members there to watch it happen. And, you know, you imagine that sort of kick in the guts. And that's look, harsh. I don't know, would that send me back to drinking? Would that send me, it certainly wouldn't send me back to drugs, but would it, you know, and I don't know. Yeah. You just got to do the best you can do and you know, be grateful for what you have, I suppose.
And I guess too, Nigel, until you're in that position, you don't know.
No.
You know, and that's a very, very good point.
But I think if there's one thing that I learned through everything that I've been through, it is, you need to have your moral compass. You need to have what are your values that you live by. And once you start deviating from them, prepare for the disaster to follow.
Because, and it will come.
And that's what happened to me. It was you know, I deviated from what was my normal and what was my acceptable. And, you know, for influences and reasons and all sorts of different reasons. And none of them are excuses, but they're just, you can sort of look back and think, well, I can't see why that happened. But that was the issue, is when you start deviating from where your moral values or your sort of compass are, it will end in tears. And I think that's probably my takeaway from it all, is that I now know that, you know, I don't want to go down that path.
Talk about the firm for a sec.
Yeah.
Let's give it a plug. And
Well, I'm running this new business called Aussie Injury, you know, running this new brand that we're running called Aussie Injury Lawyers. And basically, I suppose I just want to hear from people who have had work accidents, motor vehicle accidents. And the big area that I love is this TPD stuff, where people have these policies of insurance that the...
What is TPD?
Okay, so TPD is total permanent disability. Right. So what happens is, you know, you'll have somebody who when your pay gets taken out and the money gets sent off to MLC or HEST or whoever your superannuation company is, the superannuation company will go and take out a policy of insurance on the person so that if they become totally permanently disabled, they qualify for the payment. And the amazing thing is that I've had people ring me up and say, oh, you know, I can't work, so I went to my super company and I haven't been able to work. I'm looking at going on a pension and I've asked them, can I get $10,000?
Yeah.
And and all the while, they have a $400,000 or $300,000 or $200,000 insurance policy that they're entitled to, and the super companies don't tell them. They say, oh, look, yeah, we'll look at it. We might let you have 10 grand. They don't say, hey, Bob, why don't you go and make an application for your TPD that you've paid the premiums for? It's your money, and get the 200 grand. I mean, my partner and I went and met a lady, and it was a really sad story. It was a really confronting story, but I came into contact with this lady, and she was basically like a shut-in hoarder. Mm. And we went into her unit, and it was just like you could not walk from one side of this unit to the other. It was completely just jam-packed with stuff. Anyway, and I'd met her, she was trying to get on a disability support pension, and I said, look, you know, tell me a little bit about yourself. And, you know, she said that she'd worked at a hospital, and she had a good job, and I said, have you got any ID? And she brought out a passport, and I was like, oh, wow, you got a passport, you know, because talking about a lady who's in a really bad way. Anyway, and I said, have you been anywhere? Oh, I've been to Fiji, I've been in New Zealand. I said, oh, really? You know, and I started chatting to her. And this poor girl had just, you know, really had a massive breakdown and got herself in this situation. And she was heading to get the disability support pension. I said, well, do you know what TPD you got? And she said, you know, standard answer, what's that? And I said, well, look, who's your super with? And we looked into it. And without a word of a lie, she had $800,000 insurance and she didn't know she had it. So we put a claim in, got her the money. And, you know, talk about changing somebody's life. I mean, it doesn't fix her problem, but Jesus, you know, it makes
a
difference.
Help,
you know,
isn't it?
But the thing that shits me is that the insurance company are sitting there on 800 of her thousands of dollars. She doesn't even know she's got the right to claim, and she just didn't know. So, you know, that...
What's the contact? How do people contact you
if they
want to know
more about it? Oh, mate, just best thing, hit me up on Instagram or, you know...
Hit me up on Instagram!
Hit me up there, drop into me DMs, you know?
Not your man. Mate, listen, thank you so much for joining us here at The Clink. And it's an honour. And what a true story of redemption. I wish you nothing but success. And obviously, there's some big things coming. And, mate, listen, keep in contact with us.
Yeah, we'll do.
And we'd love to hear a little bit further down the track how you're travelling.
Good on you, mate.
Thanks again, mate.
Cheers, buddy.
No, you have it, guys. Nigel Munt, a success story, a story of redemption from The Clink here at Karama Mount Woodgie Studios. Thank you very much for listening.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way.
All the way.
For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste.
Stop calling.
For the record, 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 for the record.
Want to thank a new sponsor who's just come on board, Dr. Pickles Tattoo Aftercare and Lifestyle Products. They're made in Brisbane and are known right around the world. They have this amazing balm. It's called the Original Tattoo Balm. You seal and protect your tattoo with the OG. I've just been using it on my leg after I had it done, and I tell you now, my skin feels amazing and there's a great shine to it. They also have an antiseptic spray you can spray on and wipe over your tattoo to keep it nice and clean so you don't get any infections. They've got a 3-in-1 wash. It's all natural, smells great, packed full of peppermint, citrus, and wait for it, hemp oils. How good's that? Plus, they have a SPF 50 sunscreen, which acts as a moisturiser as well as protecting your tattoos from fading and stop them from getting sun damage. Right now, though, for the Clink listeners, they're offering 15% off with the code CLINK. Just head to drpickles.com. That's drpickles.com.